Welcome to the Up My Nursing Game podcast. I am your host, Annie Fulton. This podcast addresses common nursing questions and pitfalls with the help of doctors, expert nurses, and other healthcare staff. My hope is that knowledge sharing and friendly conversation will not only improve nursing practice, but also serve to help break down barriers that exist between nurses and hospital staff. The views expressed on this podcast and its media platforms are solely those of the participants and not their current or past employers. Please always follow your state's Board of Nursing standard of care and your institution's policies, protocols, and procedures. Today's episode is about a topic that has caused me some anxiety in the past. Caring for pregnant and lactating patients not in the antepartum or postpartum settings. For various reasons that we'll go over in the episode, women who are pregnant are not always placed on antepartum floors, and likewise, patients who are breastfeeding can be found throughout the hospital. So there's kind of a funny story behind this interview. I hadn't even considered doing an episode about anything obstetric related because I have so little experience with it and felt like I couldn't really interview effectively about this kind of topic. But a month or so ago, I was at the park with my son and I was talking to a parent there about my podcast, you know, that I have an educational nursing podcast where I interview experts. And lo and behold, at the end of our time at the park, a really friendly woman approached me. And she said, you know, I couldn't help but overhear what you had to say about your podcast. I'm an OBGYN, and I'd be interested in being on it. Hearing OBGYN gave me pause because I didn't want to break it to her that this was not something I ever imagined covering on my show. But she started to brainstorm ideas, and I quickly pivoted and thought, well, actually, there's some really good material here that I could speak to that would be helpful for nurses like me who so rarely care for these kinds of patients. So we exchanged information, and fast forward a few weeks, here is our episode. Listen in. So welcome Dr. Michelle Salone. She's an OBGYN working for the County of San Mateo, delivering babies at Stanford, where it turns out she herself was born, along with her three sons. She studied exercise science at UC Davis and ran track and cross country there. She took off 2 years, was a personal trainer and a substitute teacher before eventually going to medical school at UC Irvine. She completed her OBGYN residency at Stanford, then joined San Mateo County, where she has had the opportunity to be 80% time and still teach. Welcome to the show, Dr. Salone.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have you here too. And I never thought I would be talking about OBGYN subjects on my show, but here we are. I always like to ask my guests on the show, like, what drew you to your specialty in OBGYN?
Yeah, when I started med school, I actually thought I might want to go into emergency medicine. But then as I sort of started to check out different specialties, I realized I really like the procedures and the kind of excitement around childbirth, in addition to having some more longer-term relationships with patients in the outpatient and the clinical settings, but keeping up sort of that excitement and never knowing what's going to happen and the surgical procedures as part of being an OBGYN. So I couldn't have imagined liking the field so much, but I really love what I do.
Yeah, here you are. And I was wondering, like, obviously you're delivering babies, you're performing C-sections, but what other surgeries are you performing?
So I also do on the gynecology end, hysterectomies, so removing women's patients' uterus for abnormal bleeding or fibroids. Sometimes there's surgical management of ectopic pregnancies, removing tubes or ovarian cysts, sort of all female organ related surgeries.
Yeah, got it. I think we, as someone who has never had, female surgery, I tend to only think about the obstetric part of what you do, but
there is also that GYN part.
Yes.
So I'm excited to have you here today, not only because you're just awesome and friendly and I enjoy speaking with you, but because, you know, sometimes floor nurses like myself assume care of pregnant patients. And, you know, we're going to go over the reasons why pregnant patients aren't necessarily on an antepartum floor. But sometimes we do assume the care of a patient who is pregnant and also lactating patients. So a patient who is breastfeeding and will likely require, you know, pumping while she's at the hospital. This definitely adds a layer of complexity to a situation, and it definitely stresses me out when I get pregnant patients. And I'm hoping that you can help me and my listeners today kind of become more comfortable and familiar with pregnancy, and also how we can help mothers who are lactating and help them to continue breastfeeding, pumping while they're at the hospital. So to begin with, you know, we're talking about pregnant patients who are hospitalized for non-obstetric reasons, right? So what are some common reasons that we find pregnant women in the hospital?
Yeah, so I think some of the main reasons that pregnant patients end up getting hospitalized, particularly early on in the pregnancy for non-obstetrical reasons, are typically sort of the common reasons for hospitalization in that age group. So it could be for surgical reasons, like appendectomies, cholecystectomies, trauma, kidney infections. Even more rarely, there's some patients that are pregnant with a cancer diagnosis. They may even be undergoing chemotherapy, or there's a lot of patients as the sort of treatment for congenital cardiac anomalies has progressed so much that you had these patients that were previously children with cardiac anomalies who grow up and get pregnant, and they may have had like a repaired tetralogy of Fallot or some sort of complex cardiac anomaly who are now pregnant and then will need close cardiac care during their pregnancy.
Okay. And these are just common diagnoses of any woman who's between like in her childbearing years, right? Like 20s to 40s.
Right. Like a lot of like common. Exactly.
Got it. So let's talk about the logistics here. How is it determined whether a pregnant patient will go to an antepartum floor or to a different floor, whether it be medical, surgical, critical care?
So each hospital will have a different policy. But for the most part, what I've seen and how it is at Stanford where I work is that a patient, if they're over 20 weeks, will go to an antepartum maternity ward. And the benefit of that is that the age of viability is thought to be around 23 to 24 weeks, roughly. And so that's when fetal monitoring will become more important. But patients in the first trimester, or often sort of using 20 weeks as a cutoff, the monitoring, there's not much intervention for the fetus as it wouldn't survive outside the womb at that age. And so they will often go to a medical floor. Similarly, that's our cutoff for when a patient would go to the emergency room versus labor and delivery for a wide variety of complaints. So for example, whether that would be fever or, I mean, for trauma, we'd still have them go to the emergency department at any gestational age. But for things like nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, bleeding, even vaginal bleeding before 20 weeks, we'll often go to the emergency department, not labor and delivery.
Okay. What are the limitations on an antepartum floor? Like, let's talk about EKGs. Can nurses who work on antepartum floors interpret EKGs?
No. And so that would be also another really critical point, right, is that if we have a cardiac patient, for example, we don't do telemetry on an antepartum floor. So those patients will often be in the CCU, or even we'll end up bringing like a CCU nurse or cardiac nurse will often come in if a patient needs telemetry for the stress of labor. So we're not going to have them labor in a CCU, but then we'll have to have a labor nurse and a CCU nurse, which is very, you know, labor intensive, to have all that nursing staff in one room. But let's say they're there just for monitoring or fluid overload or something for multiple weeks, that could actually be in the CCU where they're getting telemetry. And then of course, if a patient needs ICU level care, that will also be done in ICU. So if that even means something like they need blood pressure support or any concern for intubation, like some COVID patients, for example, we're consulting on those patients in the ICU.
Okay. For pregnant patients who are in ICU, or maybe they're within the first 20 weeks of their pregnancy, in your experience, are nurses from the labor and delivery floors assisting patients in doing their own assessments? Like, do they go to the department where the pregnant woman is to help with the assessment and care?
So depending on the circumstances, sometimes we'll have a labor and delivery nurse go over to do doptones, to basically check daily, just make sure the fetus is still alive, or specifically before and after a surgery, for example, if the fetus is not viable, just kind of spot checking, do we hear fetal cardiac activity for the day? Great. After 20 weeks, if they're in the CCU, ICU, we'll often have a labor nurse go over there to do the non-stress test or NST, which is at least 20 minutes of fetal monitoring, but sometimes even longer, sometimes even continuous monitoring, depending on the exact circumstances. So in that case, yes, a labor nurse will be sent over there sometimes for the whole 24-hour period or for an entire shift to watch the fetal tracing.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. So it's conceivable that a pregnant woman in ICU will have an additional labor nurse there at all times.
Yeah, right. So I think of for example, some recent examples would be 30-week pregnant lady with COVID, for example, with low oxygen, that could affect the fetus. And so some of these women are having their baby on continuous fetal heart rate tracing. And so she'll have her ICU nurse, and then she'll also have the fetal monitor on, and then that kind of monitor, they've been in this case near the window outside of the room, but she'll be watching it through the window continuously as long as she's there. So definitely a lot of, wow. A lot of people help. Everyone's different specialties coming together.
Right. But how scary would that be? So, there have been a few times in my career as a nurse where I need to do fetal heart tone monitoring. So often what I have to work with is the little Doppler that we use on the unit to assess fetal pulses. Sometimes I can't find the fetal pulse, and it can be really stressful, not only for me, but especially for the mom who is just, worried to death that, why can't you hear anything? I'm always coaching my patients, I'm going to use this monitor first. It's not that great. So please don't worry if we can't hear anything. And I am very quick to call the L&D floor at my hospital and ask, hey, I have a pregnant patient here. I really try to establish a relationship with whoever is working that day and say, hey, I can't hear the heartbeat using my little dinky Doppler here. Could you come down and check the heart tones? What point in pregnancy can you kind of reliably hear fetal heart tones?
Yeah, so after 10 weeks, you can start to hear them. But I will say in the first trimester, especially, it can be really challenging. And honestly, even in the first 20 weeks, it can be challenging depending on the maternal body habitus. And so, yeah, searching around can definitely be challenging. But I think it's always worth calling L&D for support to come bring over the doptones from labor and delivery, or even honestly, sometimes the residents or myself will bring over an ultrasound to just visualize the fetal cardiac activity, depending on the maternal body habitus, is very, very reasonable. So I don't think there's any need to sort of worry or struggle.
Yeah. I think a good important point to bring up, because I think nurses like to be as autonomous as possible sometimes. If we don't need to bring in the extra help, then don't do it. But when we're talking about a fetus here, go ahead, call your L&D department, get the correct Doppler, get an ultrasound if you need to. I think this is something no one's going to fault you for asking for extra help.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the physiology of pregnancy, besides the obvious of having a fetus in your uterus. But what are some of the anatomical, physiologic differences between a pregnant and a non pregnant patient?
Yeah, so one of the main things is that the blood volume will increase in pregnancy. But interestingly, the plasma volume is going to increase more than the actual red blood cells. And so there is some component of dilutional anemia. Along these lines, there's an increase in the cardiac output. So the stroke volume and the heart rate will go up slightly, but there's a decrease in vascular resistance, which means that you actually expect the blood pressure to be lower, sort of nadiring around 24 weeks or so, and then return to normal levels by the end of the third trimester. There is also an increased risk for blood clots during pregnancy. So sort of the mechanism being that your body is almost being protective against postpartum hemorrhage after delivery. And so that's how I kind of think of it. So your body can clot more easily, though, meaning there's a higher risk of pulmonary embolism, DVTs, stroke, et cetera. And so, you know, kind of keeping that in mind, it's important for mobilization and SCDs. If you have a patient hospitalized for whether it's surgery or just any prolonged hospitalization, to just really keep that in mind. And along those lines, it's not uncommon for pregnant ladies around hospitalization to need Lovenox or heparin. We don't do Coumadin, which we can talk about medications later, but just given that increased clot risk. On other organ systems, the white cells do increase slightly. And so the mean white cell count in pregnant patients is often around like 10 and a half. So something like 11 or 12 isn't necessarily abnormal. The lung capacity decreases in pregnancy, as you can imagine, as the gravid uterus starts pushing on the diaphragm. So the lung capacity is actually decreased, but there is a slight increase in tidal volume. And so, and also there's like some sensation of dyspnea is normal in pregnancy, as you want that gradient to be even more. So you want the mom's CO2 to be less so that the baby can diffuse the CO2 out to the mom, and likewise the O2 higher to diffuse into the baby. So it's going to kind of create the sensation of shortness, of a slight sensation of shortness of breath, but the actual respiratory rate should not be the same. So those parameters are the same.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah. And then finally, by sort of organ systems, with the kidneys, the glomerular filtration rate, or GFR, is going to increase. So some medications, particularly like seizure medications, thyroid medications, due to kidney function, and also then some hormonal changes may need adjustments and may need some labs to check some medication levels in pregnancy, as the dosing needs may be a little bit different. Sort of speaking of the renal system, the progesterone, the hormone in pregnancy that's kind of progesterone, like progestation, is going to keep the uterus from contracting. It acts to relax smooth muscle in ways, which is helpful for preventing like preterm labor. But that hormone is also going to decrease the smooth muscle in the gastrointestinal tract. And so gastric emptying will be slowed, bowel intestinal like transit time will sort of be slowed, and so you'll get the GI side effects of pregnancy, like constipation, nausea, vomiting, all related to those pregnancy hormones. And even with the kidneys, the progesterone relaxes the ureters, so that's why you get even more risk. Besides, it just kind of compounds the risk of pyelonephritis or like kidney stones in pregnancy by sort of relaxing and dilating the ureters.
Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't realize, I hadn't connected that progesterone was, you know, the causative agent in all of these kind of physiologic differences.
All things good and bad.
exactly. Yeah.
And then they're sort of like non-hormonal things, but other important physiologic changes of pregnancy is that the gravid uterus, as everyone can imagine, becomes pretty large. And so there's just the actual pressure that a uterus with up to, you know, like an 8-pound baby, 9-pound baby, even 10-pound baby is putting on structures, including things like the vena cava, for example, most notably. So it can decrease the blood return to the heart. And that can look like clinically manifest as varicose veins or hemorrhoids, you know, sort of all like things below the heart, the sort of venous stasis in addition to blood clots. But also I bring this up just because heaven forbid anyone ever have to do CPR on a pregnant woman, whether that's hopefully not coding someone on a floor or in an emergency department, but just to be aware of, it's really important, is that if you're ever called, besides, you know, of course, calling an OB code, if you're at a hospital where there's an OB team available, is that effective CPR in a pregnant person over 20 weeks, which in 20 weeks, the benchmark is the uterus above the umbilicus. Effective CPR requires pushing the uterus, like displacing the uterus to the left, basically trying to think about pushing that uterus off of the vena cava to allow as much blood return to the heart as possible. So just a little tidbit, if anyone hears this, just to keep in mind.
Yeah. Let's hope no one ever has to provide CPR to a pregnant patient. Wow. You know, a big topic that I'm sure you're consulted on is the usage of medications in a pregnant patient. When I used to flow to emergency, there's always this kind of concern about a pregnant patient coming in who's in pain. What can we safely give her?
Yeah, I think this is one of the biggest misconceptions, and I think it causes a lot of our patients to suffer unnecessarily, is that I think we'll just start with a perspective that even in labor, for example, women often receive IV fentanyl, like women without an epidural, even 50, 100 of fentanyl. So to give someone who comes in with a kidney stone or who comes in with a tibial fracture or some very acute thing, it's very reasonable to give them IV dilaudid or IV morphine, essentially to treat them as if they were not pregnant. That's really the risk with narcotics in pregnancy, is more for chronic pain medication use, right? So really you can think about pain medication use similar to how you would think about a non-pregnant person, right? Is that someone's not going to get addicted to pain medications for treating acute pain or post-surgical pain. It's just the chronic use that becomes more concerning, right? So if someone is on taking Vicodin for back pain every single day of their pregnancy, that would not be ideal. There's concern for neonatal withdrawal, but definitely in the short term, that's very reasonable. And just be reassured. You can even reassure your patient if they're, you know, have a kidney stone or they're about to go to, they have appendicitis, right? You can even tell them, don't worry, the OBs give patients IV pain medication in labor frequently. Like this, it's like, let's get you more comfortable. You know, the only medication that we need to think twice about are NSAIDs. So, which is unfortunate, meaning like no Toradol, none of that's like we're taking out a non-narcotic option, which makes, besides Tylenol, the narcotics even more essential, just because there's some concern with prolonged use of NSAIDs that they can prematurely close the fetal ductus arteriosus. And so we do try to avoid NSAIDs in pregnancy, but like aspirin, Tylenol, narcotics are completely fine. Similarly, antibiotics, I mean, of course, always consult the obstetrician admin-acquisition will consult the obstetrician, but most antibiotics are even fine. Like this, thinking primarily of the strongest ones, like vancomycin, Zosyn are all completely fine in pregnancy. And really, I think like one of the things I just want to take away is I think non-OB providers or nurses or physicians, really everyone out that doesn't take care of these patients every day, reasonably just has a lot more concern than is warranted. I think the most important message is that pregnant patients are in a lot of ways similar to other patients and should be treated similarly to how other patients would be treated. I think it's a disservice to some of the care that gets withheld because of a fear of pregnancy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think we're all like hyper concerned about the fetus for obvious reasons, but I mean, we got to take care of mom too. And I've definitely seen that hyper concern play out in my own pregnancy, where I went into urgent care once and the doctor didn't even want to give me Zofran. I think some of it has to do with the fact that there are not a lot of studies maybe done with pregnant patients and medications for the obvious, you know, ethical concerns of that. But I really like your point. Like most of the time you can treat a pregnant woman the same as a non-pregnant woman, with the exception of NSAIDs. I think that's important to keep in mind too. because you think like, oh, NSAIDs are generally pretty harmless, but this is like one of those special cases where they can be quite harmful.
Right. Where it seems counterintuitive to say, actually, it'd be better for this patient to get Norco than Motrin, right? But that's an even more strong reason to be like, if Tylenol won't do it, then we really need to think about what else can be done for pain control in the acute setting. And then the other sort of area where I see this come up a lot, where sort of important medical care is withheld, is related to imaging. There's a lot of concerns about radiation in pregnancy. And I think the takeaway there is, of course, ultrasound is preferable. MRIs are good, but if a CT is needed to make an important diagnosis, even a CT of the abdomen with or without contrast can be done if it's going to dictate management, right? So this could look like someone in the emergency room that comes in for a trauma. Often the OB team will be called down there as well. And I feel like half of our job is to reassure them, like we'll check and make sure there's fetal cardiac activity, but to reassure them to say, no, it's okay. Like take her to the CT scanner. You know, if she's hypotensive, if you're afraid that she has undiagnosed or some concern for intra-abdominal bleeding, you know, from like a liver laceration or splenic laceration, like we need to know that. Like the most important thing you can do to save the fetus is save the mom. You don't want her to have an undiagnosed bleed.
Oh, absolutely.
Like get the CT scan, right? So I'm not saying, oh, just everyone with abdominal pain should get a CT scan. But in that case, it would be better to get the CT scan to make that diagnosis. Or, you know, if there's a concern for pulmonary embolism, we often get CTs of the chest in pregnant women. Or even, you know, for appendix is another good example. Missing appendicitis in pregnancy is also very dangerous. So while it'd be great if to start with an ultrasound, often though the appendix isn't visualized on ultrasound. So then, you know, you can proceed with an MRI. You actually, to caveat that, you can't use the MRI contrast gadolinium, but if that's not an option, then yeah, get the CT of the actual abdomen where the fetus is to look at the appendix. It's just sort of all weighing the benefits, the risks and the benefits to make sure the patient's getting the best care, the most accurate diagnosis.
All right. That's good to know that contrast is not an absolute contraindication, right? Like you have to weigh the risks and the benefits, obviously, but it can be given to a pregnant
patient.
Correct. Okay.
Correct.
What about X-ray?
Yeah, similarly, definitely fine. I mean, I'm trying to think what comes to my mind even routinely. For example, like women that are testing positive for QuantiFERON, we routinely get chest X-rays in pregnancy to look for evidence of active tuberculosis.
Oh, okay.
And definitely X-rays of the extremity would be completely fine. But just like a CT of the abdomen would be fine to look for appendicitis if needed. Really, any X-ray would be totally fine if indicated.
Okay. Okay.
But I would have very low concern about, you know, X-raying a foot, or we do the chest all the time, or, you know, a hand looking for fractures like that.
Okay. Okay.
And I think that's something too, is I know sometimes, of course, like the nurses won't be making this decision, but to just, I feel like patients will often ask the nurse or will be hesitant, the patients themselves, you know, to say like, oh, I don't know if I should get an X-ray when I'm pregnant, to just, you know, provide reassurance that the evidence really does suggest that this is important to treat and that the amount of radiation need to do fetal harm is much, much, much higher than one X-ray. Or even if they're just getting an X-ray of their foot or their leg to say, you know, no, like, some women even get CT scans, which have much more radiation of their abdomen. Like, don't even think twice about getting your ankle X-rayed. Like, your baby will be fine, to sort of provide that reassurance, to empower the patient to proceed with the care if the patient is just kind of wants that yeah, extra set of opinion. Because, like, I don't know, I feel like often the nurses are at bedside and the patient might not voice this concern to their physician. Well, they're like, okay, we're going to get an X-ray. And then the patient is, I don't know, this is how I perceive it, or this is even what I do as a patient. They say to the nurse, like, what do you think? I don't know. I'm really scared about doing this. Meanwhile, you know, like their bones almost sticking out of their leg and they're like, I don't know, you know,
No, I think patients definitely, you know, maybe a few things happen, but they kind of freeze up in front of the doctor and they forget like all the questions that they have while the doctor's there, or they think of questions afterwards. You know, that's a common thing too. But I think definitely nurses are find themselves in the position of, you know, providing education and in this case, you know, reassurance to a patient, like, this x-ray is not going to harm your baby and is, you know, indicated. So yeah, no, I definitely think that nurses can play a role in not only imaging, but in medications too. When we're talking about like pain medications, just, you know, explain that, you know, it's okay to get a narcotic while you're pregnant. If it's an acute situation, not chronic, just say like, you know, it's okay. And, you know, the doctor likely, you know, he or she wouldn't order it if it wasn't safe.
Right. And the pharmacy often, you know, it's flagged that the patient's pregnant. There's often many checks on these sorts of things.
So let's go over, before we go on to, you know, lactating patients, I just want to go over like the assessment of a pregnant patient. So we talked about the fetal heart tones. Like, what are some other important assessments that we can do on our pregnant patients?
Yeah, so there are some things that are unique to the pregnant patient that we want to keep in the differential and just sort of keep an eye on. And the way when I'm teaching medical students on labor and delivery, we call it sort of the ABCs of pregnancy. A is for amniotic fluid, right? So this is going to separate like a pregnant patient from a non-pregnant patient in some ways, right? So if you have a patient on the floor and they may complain that they're leaking clear fluid, or they're not sure. Oftentimes, even when they come to triage, they might say, I don't know if I just like peed myself or if my water broke. And especially in the hospital setting, right? Like maybe they have a lot of lines, or they need to push their call button to get up to go to the bathroom, or they're getting a ton of fluids. So it really is a possibly like confusing situation. Like, was this an episode of urinary incontinence or did their water just break? And so, you know, one way to differentiate that is to put on like a pad and see if there's continued leaking. But honestly, something like that where there's concern, like did the water break, is definitely a reason to call the obstetrical team. And it's really easy to do a swab to differentiate, you know, urine from the amniotic fluid, and just sort of assess. Because sometimes these patients, when they are admitted, for a variety of causes, are at risk for premature rupture of membranes or preterm premature rupture of membranes. So,
okay. Question about this, since I don't have experience with this, is this need to be ordered, this swab, to check for the amniotic fluid?
Yeah. And it would likely be done by, depending on the hospital, it would likely be done by the obstetrician themselves. They may even do a speculum exam and come over. Yeah. It would be sent to a lab, or depending on the place, may just be like nitrosamine paper, but it would definitely be a test done by the obstetricians, if after they heard the patient explain the story and the nurse explain the story, if they thought that the testing was warranted. But okay. I just want to provide reassurance that patients often come to labor and delivery directly all the time saying, I don't know if I peed myself or my water broke. just like, it could be easily confused. So don't feel bad. Like, we would hate to miss someone's water breaking when everyone just like, oh, it's probably just urine, you know? So that's something to just kind of keep in mind. So that's A, amniotic fluid. The B is for bleeding. So any amount of vaginal bleeding in pregnancy is going to be abnormal and should warrant a call to the, or page to the covering obstetrician. The C is for contractions. So this can present in a variety of ways, but sort of cyclic abdominal pain, or really any abdominal pain, should warrant a call to the, this is just kind of all the reasons to call the OB team. So to the on-call team, contractions. D is for dysuria. So as we talked about before, pyelonephritis is a common reason for hospitalization in pregnancy, but any dysuria warrants a urine analysis and culture, just because it can be so serious. The risk of anemia or even respiratory distress from pyelonephritis in pregnancy is high. So that's the D.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The E is for edema. So some degree of bilateral edema is common in the pregnant woman, as we talked about, from the pressure on the vena cava. But really any like redness or unilateral edema, you want to keep on the differential for DVTs due to the hypercoagulable state of pregnancy. And then also, though, so the other thing with edema to keep in mind is while some degree of bilateral edema is fine, if this edema is associated with elevated blood pressure, so meaning over 140 or 90, that can be a sign of preeclampsia. So that's something to note, the covering of OB team of, if any edema is noted. And then the F is for fetal movement. So in the hospital setting, that will involve fetal monitoring, but changes in fetal movements would be notable. So those are kind of the different things, the additional things to keep in mind, or when to call off the floor team.
Yeah. So a couple quick questions about some of these points. For we were talking about preeclampsia. Like, at what point in pregnancy do women start experiencing preeclampsia? Like, when should your kind of radar start going up about this?
So most commonly, it's closer to term, near 36, 37 weeks. But really, any newly elevated blood pressures over 140 over 90 after 20 weeks, when they were the first 20 weeks and outside of pregnancy were normal, would fall into this gestational hypertension or pregnancy-induced hypertension category.
Okay.
And it's more dangerous the earlier it's diagnosed. So working it up, like anyone over 20 weeks, if there's a blood pressure over 140, over 90, it will likely warrant a set of labs to look at other things that preeclampsia affects, like the kidneys, the liver, the platelets, just sort of. It doesn't mean they're going to get delivered. It just warrants this lab. So it's worth calling for any elevated blood pressures.
Absolutely. Moving on to, you know, care of the lactating patient. So, right, this is a woman who's breastfeeding and will likely require pumping when she's in the hospital. And maybe we could talk a little bit about logistics now. Like, at what point would a patient be sent to a regular floor or unit after birth? Like, is there a certain cutoff date that at which a patient will be considered for postpartum versus elsewhere in the hospital?
Yeah, so typically within the first 6 weeks, a lot of readmissions will go back to postpartum, whether that's for anything possibly related to birth, right? Whether that's like abnormal bleeding or possibly like endometritis or like an infection of the uterus. Readmissions for preeclampsia, like elevated blood pressures, things like that. And the benefit of doing that, especially within the first 6 weeks, is often if there's another supervising adult, that their baby can come with them still to stay in that room, which is really helpful for the lactating moms.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So it sounds like more or less, you know, a patient who's within the first 6 weeks of delivering will go to a postpartum floor. But after that, you know, she'll often go, you know, elsewhere to the within the hospital. I'm really excited to talk to you today about advocating for pumping while patients are in the hospital, because our listeners who haven't breastfed before, or, you know, they don't have any experience with this, it's pretty confusing and maybe don't know how stressful this is for moms. How can nurses best advocate for their breastfeeding patients? Like, how can we help promote pumping while they're at the hospital?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is a really important topic. And again, sometimes even a patient within the first 6 weeks may go to a medicine floor if the admission is for a non-obstetrical related issue. I think this can just be like very, very stressful for all involved, because for many patients, this may be the first time they've left their baby, and whatever the reason, right? It's serious enough that they're getting admitted to the hospital. And so I think this is where nurses can be a huge place of support. One, in that even recognizing that the patient is still breastfeeding. This might not come up in discussion with other providers because they may be so fixated on top, or so, you know, focused on talking about their own issue, and that someone, the surgeon or someone, may be saying, okay, you're going to need surgery tomorrow to remove your gallbladder. And the patient's probably asking, like, when can I go home? How long is this going to take? What, tell me about the surgery. And then not even get to the point of like, oh, and I have, you know, a 3-month at home. They've never had a bottle. Like, there's just so many stressors. Who's watching it? So many social components to this. But also, like, the engorgement, like, even just in the emergency room, like, even while waiting, the patient may not own a pump. They may have came to the hospital emergently and not brought a pump. And so I think it all really starts with even just getting a pump for the breastfeeding mom in the emergency room, or as soon as possible on the floor. A hospital grade pump can be really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
This can often be obtained by calling the postpartum unit to help them coordinate where to get one. They're likely not just sitting around. I don't know. You probably know, but I don't think they're sitting around on many units.
No, not my experience.
Just, to call postpartum to get a hospital grade pump, as really some people may be nursing every 2 to 3 hours, and it's just going to get even really uncomfortable, you know, by after that time. Oh, so sitting in the ER for 6 hours, they may be very, very engorged. And so that can just be so helpful. And then the other thing I think is there's this culture of pumping and dumping, like in the emergency room, like, oh, you just got like this pain medication, which is just dump this milk. This baby may have never had formula before. And we don't want to make this hospitalization a reason why this baby needs to have formula who otherwise wouldn't get it, especially because most medications are actually very safe. And so I think what's really important is if you don't know, if most things are honestly actually fine in the milk, especially if the baby's slightly older, so to just save the milk, write down what time it was collected. Then from that, you'll be able to tell, you know, what medications were given before that from the MAR. And then kind of, you can clarify later, but to just default pour the milk down the sink feels like a tragedy.
Oh, absolutely. It's like throwing away like liquid gold. Right? Like I remember when I was breastfeeding, there was always this weight on my shoulders about pumping and maintaining my supply. And if I ever had to throw away milk because it sat out or, you know, whatever reason, it was just a huge tragedy.
Right. Right. And then compound that on being in the hospital for whatever reason. So
yeah.
Just,
I like,
and then also in non-COVID times, if it's possible for the baby to like a caretaker to even bring the baby at times so that it can direct nurse or that someone can be picking up this milk. Like there's so many different ways to help.
Yeah.
Support this and make this a little bit less stressful for the patient. And then another myth, as I think people sort of sometimes feel like, especially even patients in the ICU or that are very sick, like, oh, don't quote unquote, like waste your energy breastfeeding. Like you need to like spend your energy recovering. And one, like it's just could be very physically uncomfortable for the patient to stop pumping, but also like, there's not really a lot of science behind saying that breastfeeding is going to delay your recovery or that pumping is going to delay your recovery. Right. So I've even had patients wake up in the ICU after, you know, maybe being intubated for a hemorrhage at the time of delivery and just be in tears. Like, you know, like the family knew or the OBs knew they had a desire to breastfeed, and the ICU nurse, we may have got a pump to the room. The ICU nurse may have been helping them, pumping their milk, collecting milk for them to sort of stimulate the milk supply in the first few days, literally waking up in tears, being like, on, you know, I don't know what day, say like postpartum day 3, but like just literally like being like, I can't believe you did that for me. Like, aww. You know, they're thinking about their own recovery, but wow, like you just helped me to like not crush my breastfeeding dreams by helping me pump, you know. And of course it was known ahead of time or from the patient's partner that was their desire to breastfeed. It's not like we're just pumping all intubated postpartum patients.
That's so sweet.
But like such a big deal, and it doesn't hurt their recovery, right? It's not like, oh, they're in ICU, we shouldn't waste their energy, they need to heal, right? Like it's safe to do that, and in such a kind gesture.
Yeah. Oh, that's a really great point to make. I could see where there would be concern for that, right? Like a fair amount of energy has to go into producing breast milk. I think if there's no study showing that, you know, it hinders a recovery and you're providing peace of mind to this new mom, then I like that. Just help with breastfeeding whenever possible. So we talked about how most medications are compatible with breastfeeding. What medications are not?
So the first one that kind of, the main one that comes to my mind is medications like Tylenol with codeine. Or tramadol, which aren't prescribed as much anymore. Although I know for a while they like Tylenol with codeine was really popular because it wasn't like controlled in the same way, so it felt like sort of like a light narcotic. But it can be really dangerous with breastfeeding in that it has a more unpredictable metabolism. Everyone kind of metabolizes it different, and so it can end up with like very high levels of high levels of metabolites that can cause respiratory depression. The FDA actually put an alert on it that you shouldn't give it to kids under 12. But for that reason, like it should definitely not be used in breastfeeding women, as we don't know how the infant will metabolize it. So that's That's the main one. Of course, unlike in pregnancy, NSAIDs we love postpartum. So Toradol, Motrin, ibuprofen are really great options for a lot of pain control afterwards. Most antibiotics are fine. Really, anything that you would give to prescribe to a baby or a child is fine. And again, it's something that can easily be checked with the consulting OB team if there's any questions.
Okay. What about contrast?
Also fine.
Okay.
Yeah. That's another thing too. Is we often hear like, oh, you should pump and dump for like 24 hours following imaging, but there's really not good evidence behind that. Same thing with receiving general anesthesia. There's sort of a default to say like, oh, pump and dump for 24 hours after surgery. But if the anesthesiologist knows ahead of time that the woman's breastfeeding, there's certain types of anesthesia that can be used. And really it's for like same day surgeries, for example, as soon as the mom's like awake enough to hold the baby, it's safe to breastfeed.
Okay. Okay. And then just quickly, narcotics, are they okay for breastfeeding?
Yes. So again, like this is something like a lot of women have major abdominal surgery to have their baby in the form of a cesarean section. And so those are very, very small babies with like very like new livers that we still give those moms frequently oxycodone or Vicodin. As I always tell my patients, like, I'd rather you take the breastfeeding patients, like, I'd rather you take oxycodone and be able to walk around and change your baby's diaper and care for your child than try to be really tough, but just lay there perfectly still and not do anything because it hurts too bad to move and then get a blood clot. Or, you know, like it's okay and almost encouraged. It's an acute setting, right? We're not saying, oh, you're going to need oxycodone every day for the rest of your life. But if you need oxycodone for 4 days following your C-section or for 2 days following your cholecystectomy, like, please take it. Please use it so you can do what you need to do.
No, I think that's a great point. And that kind of goes back to what you were pointing out earlier, that pregnant women are at a higher risk for blood clots and DVTs. So, you know, this is a tool in our toolbox that we can give moms, because I'm guessing that women who are postpartum are also at risk for blood clots.
Exactly. Yes.
So I know you were hospitalized after pregnancy. Would you be willing to share your story and perhaps how nurses were able to help you with the pumping during your hospitalization?
Oh, yeah. So when my youngest child was about 8 months, I had kidney stones. So first of all, just reassurance, I personally, like, what did they even give me? Toradol, maybe morphine. Either way, and then ended up needing two surgeries actually to remove the stones. And I had the most amazing nurses who, one, got me a pump, because even though at one point, actually, before the second surgery, I was like septic and I like literally was feel like I was always asleep, but I would like wake up every time I would wake up, I would just want a pump. And so they brought me this hospital grade pump, which was even better than the one I had at home, which was really helpful. And then it was so kind, they actually brought me a mini fridge to put in my room. And then I started running out of bottles, so they brought me all these like urine, like sterile specimen collection cups, because I didn't know how long I was going to be in the hospital, right? So I end up, and I would have to call them every time and like get it sent off. I don't know where they even want to put it, in some public refrigerator or something. So I end up having a mini fridge in my room with all these like sterile specimen cups full of milk. But it was like really, really like stressful to me, thinking like, oh, I don't want to have to give him formula for the first time if I run out of milk. And no matter how sick I was, that's where I think, you know, when it was, I just felt really, really supported. And it was just so kind to get me all those supplies so I wouldn't at least have to worry.
I especially like the fact that they brought you your own refrigerator. Like,
I know.
So I didn't even know that was a thing.
But it was really helpful, because literally otherwise I think I would have just had the milk sitting out until someone could come. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I would have felt bad to keep calling them every time I pumped.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure there's definitely workarounds, but it just made it really convenient.
Exactly.
For me. So
exactly. And I think, you know, I was talking a little bit earlier about how nurses want to be autonomous when possible. Like, patients do too. And you don't want to have to put on the call light for every little thing. So it's right. just like takes, you know, some more weight off your shoulders while you were in such a state. That's awesome. And talking about, you know, breastfeeding, I think it's important to point out that, you know, sometimes women are breastfeeding beyond that first year. And that's somewhere where that's a place where nurses can kind of uncover this that maybe doctors wouldn't, is that maybe a mom who's breastfeeding, like a 16-month-old, wouldn't admit to a physician that she's still breastfeeding. But that's something that, you know, if a nurse establishes rapport with a patient, that she can uncover that information.
Yeah, I think that's probably honestly like where it's most likely to get missed, right? Because if someone's, you know, maybe 3 to 6 months postpartum, it's likely, you know, discussed it, oh, like in part of their past medical history. But, you know, like the World Health Organization actually even recommends breastfeeding until 2, and many women are breastfeeding even beyond that. Like maybe they even have like a 3-year-old that's like nursing for comfort at night. Mm-hmm. And so,
yeah, you hear about that.
They've never been away. Maybe they've never been away from them, right? And so it's still, they still may be uncomfortable with a prolonged hospitalization. They may want to still pump and use that milk or not use that milk, but it's definitely worth knowing and kind of reassuring them that the medications they're taking are safe if that's the case.
Yeah. Yeah. I also wanted to talk about, you know, some of the physiological differences that happened during the postpartum period. Like I remember for me, my blood pressure went up after pregnancy, which is weird. I never had high blood pressure in my life. And then all of a sudden I had high blood pressure and I was sweating all the time. But like, can we go through some of like the assessment findings and some of the physiologic changes that happened during the postpartum period?
Yeah. So in the days like immediately following delivery, there's a lot of what we call like fluid shifts. So the uterus was previously getting something like 1 liter of blood per minute to the fetus. And then all of a sudden, all of this blood is basically shunted elsewhere as the uterus clamps down, and all this blood goes back to the heart. And so that can be just a really risky time for heart failure or pulmonary edema, as you have all this return of fluids to the rest of the body, not to the uterus. Also, typically we think of the cure for preeclampsia as being delivery of the placenta, but really preeclampsia, it can present really any time technically within like 6 weeks, but especially within 72 hours and then 2 weeks after delivery are still other critical time frames where blood pressure may go up and a patient may need to be started on antihypertensives to just make sure, right? Like her blood pressure typically is probably actually lower during pregnancy. So something like a blood pressure over 160 or over 110 can actually just be really dangerous for a stroke, for a hemorrhagic stroke, because if her blood pressure is used to being so low, like it's not like someone with chronic hypertension who has a blood pressure of 170, like that can be really high pressure in the brain. And so we just take that very, very serious and would want to treat that. And so it's not uncommon for a patient to need blood pressure medication for a couple weeks only, not for the rest of your life, just for a couple weeks after delivery.
So just out of curiosity here, like why do you administer antihypertensives after pregnancy, but then, correct me if I'm wrong, but the treatment for preeclampsia during pregnancy is magnesium?
Oh, so yeah. So the magnesium, which it can be given either just after delivery or during pregnancy, is for to prevent seizures. So that can still be given. We typically only dose that one time. And then actually similarly, like blood pressure medication can be given either during pregnancy or after, but that will be more for preventing strokes. So both can be important either time, but really it's what's really important. And I think, yeah, magnesium gets very much associated with preeclampsia, and that's for preventing eclampsia. But what's even more common is really aggressively treating high blood pressures. And so a blood pressure over 160 or over 110 would actually warrant like very quick, like urgent IV antihypertensive administration to control that. We typically use pushes of either like hydralazine or labetalol, okay. But that's taken very seriously.
So there's the fluid shifts, there's change in blood pressures. What about, is there anemia after birth?
And Yes, often from the acute blood loss. So even with a C-section, a liter of blood loss can be common with a C-section, or even up to like 500, sometimes even more with a vaginal delivery. And so that is to be expected as well. And we'll often send the patients home on iron, or occasionally they'll need a blood transfusion, but many patients will be put on iron after delivery.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that you could lose that much blood from a C-section.
Yeah, which is, it's kind of crazy. You know, think about how, like, looping back, do we do other surgeries? Like, if someone lost a liter of blood in a hysterectomy, that would feel very, like, extreme, like, call in the blood, like, what's happening? Like, it would become, like, kind of like an emergency. But after, like, 1 liter or 900 in a C-section, actually, like, for example, like, 800 or 900 cc's during a C-section would be like, okay, like, normal. So yeah, it was a very high blood loss, a very high blood loss event.
Yeah, but it sounds like, you know, her body is prepared for that and has that extra blood volume all ready to go.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, I think that's about it. Thank you for having me. I think the main thing, again, I think nurses can be such a huge advocate for pregnant and lactating patients. And I think there's so many fears, not just on the healthcare providers, but on the side of the patient, right? And social components of being hospitalized, and just nobody wants to be hospitalized. But when you're pregnant, there's definitely increased anxiety. If you have a new baby at home, there's definitely so much anxiety. And so just sort of not only the social support, but just providing, just not giving into those fears. I think it's really important for all healthcare providers to be providing like scientific-based information and sort of reassurance to patients. Like don't even worry about it. Like, your team knows you're pregnant. These medications are safe for your baby. The most important thing for you is to keep you safe. That's what's going to keep your baby the healthiest, right? It's like, our number one job is to keep you healthy so your baby can be healthy, and just kind of provide reassurance for everyone in that way.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great takeaway. And that's something I definitely learned during our interview today, is like, how many medications are in fact quite safe for moms and their babies, like far more than I would have guessed. And so it's important that nurses, you know, be ready to explain this to our patients who are given narcotics. Like, it's okay, you can safely take them, because they probably will need that kind of extra reassurance. Well, thank you so much for being here today. I appreciate you taking the time. Thanks.
Thanks, Annie. Bye.
All right. That was a lot of information, but I just hope that after listening to Dr. Salon that you feel a little more comfortable with caring for your pregnant and lactating patients. Please continue to help me get the word out there about this podcast by sharing it with your fellow nursing friends and colleagues. All right, that's it for today. I hope that you have upped your nursing game.